STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Hello, my friends, and welcome to our show. It's called Stand to Reason, and I am Greg Kokel, your host. Glad to be with you today, and looking forward to talking with you as well. Just for the record, my number is 855-243-9975. That means wherever you are in the world, on Tuesday evenings from 4 until 6 p.m. Los Angeles time, you can dial that number and talk to the enforcer and get on board and chat with me. I'd love to do so. Now, let's see. I don't know what the numbers are for you. I think this is coming 2 days later, so probably when you get this will be 15 days until Christmas, something to that effect. But what I did in the last show is I talked a little bit about some things to do that I do, really, to try to restore what was for me as a youngster a really magical time around Christmas growing up in Chicago with a fairly large family. It wasn't large by our standards. We had five kids. There were four other families on our block in one area that I lived that had nine or more. So I lived in a Catholic Polish neighborhood, and there were lots and lots and lots of kids. But by today's standards, there are a lot, and it wasn't just our kids and then mom and dad. That's seven. It was Nani and Papa, my grandma and grandpa on my mom's side. My dad was an orphan, but that was two more, and then friends and relative people would come by, and boyfriends and girlfriends as people got older. It was quite a fun time and magical for me. Things have changed, and we're grown-ups now, which doesn't mean we lose necessarily the mystery of a time like this, but it does mean we've got a lot more responsibilities, which does seem to dampen the spirit a bit. And so I suggested in our last show that if you want to restore some of the wonder, you have to work at it. And I encourage you to first slow down. Secondly, be intentional about being together with the important people in your life. And third, to simplify. But there are some other things that I do that have that I just try to remind myself to make a part of this next 3 weeks, our Advent season, to strengthen the sense of wonder with my family around Christmas time. And I had mentioned last time that one way you want to simplify is by not sending Christmas cards out. That's a way of making your life a lot easier, okay? But if you are committed to doing that, that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But I suggest that you do it right. That is, you do not squander the opportunity. And here's the thought. This is the single time all year long where people who are not followers of Jesus expect you to send them something in the mail that talks about Jesus. They're expecting it. They're not going to get bugged. You send them a Jesus note in June, it might bother them, but not in December. And since they're expecting you to do it, my suggestion is that you do not let them down. That is, if you send out a Christmas card, please do not send a card that says Happy Holidays on it. You will be cooperating with a evisceration of Christmas that that the secular public is happily carrying out. Yeah, they want to make it Happy Holidays, but you don't have to do that. You can tell them about Jesus. Now, what I've made available in the past and will probably be posted tomorrow by Amy Hall on our blog is a list of things that I have either taken from other Christmas cards or I have written myself and used in Christmas cards that my wife has made in the past that we've sent out. And you are free, if you would like, to purloin those for your own purpose. you're making your own cards or whatever, grab some of this and build that in. Some of it is just thinking of Christmas carols. Joy to the world, the Lord has come. Let earth receive her King. Hey, that's great. Let every heart prepare him room. There's a lot of different verses you could use, but why not this Christmas send out a card that says something about Christ? Man, what an idea. Choose a meaningful Christmas card, okay, or make your own. That's all I'm saying. And this could make all the difference in the world. If you say something substantive about Christianity, maybe, and Christ, maybe you will get somebody thinking in a productive way. Maybe you'll put a stone in their shoe. Greet people in a Christmas way. That's another thing you can do. But I suggest you don't say happy holidays, obviously. I would like to think that would go without saying, but looking at many of my friends' Christmas cards, it's not the case. Also, I don't think you should say Merry Christmas. And here's why. Merry Christmas. I mean, I'm glad if you do, great. I think, though, Merry Christmas is the kind of thing that everybody says so much that it almost becomes a little bit trite during the season. You appreciate it, and you respond, oh, Merry Christmas to you or whatever. But I've adopted more of, I think, at a British standard, which is Happy Christmas. Why do I say that? The same reason that I don't say saved regarding salvation, but I say rescued. It's not an overworn phrase when I say rescued. It's a refreshing way of putting an older thing. And by the same token, pardon me, to say Happy Christmas is to greet somebody in a way a little bit different than they're used to hearing, and it might make a bigger impression on them, okay? You can also, we've done in the past, taken a magnetic car sticker of Stable in Bethlehem, a Keep Christ in Christmas. It says that. We put it on our cars. That's another thing we've done to try to remind people of the meaning of Christmas. We play CDs of Christmas music like many other people, and again, this is not a new idea, but my daughters were chomping at the bit on Thanksgiving evening. Is Thanksgiving over with, Dad? Can we just play some Christmas music now? And I said, no, wait, one more day, okay? But now they play it all the time because they love listening to that music, and it just fills the house with a special sense that's associated with that particular season. Another thing that we do is we have nativities around. Nativity scene. We probably got about five of them, and the girls love playing with them. And so they set them up in different places. They're just reminders to them about what this season is really meant to celebrate. It is meant to celebrate the coming of God to our planet in the person of a child. Sacrifice and burnt offerings you have not desired, but a body you have prepared for me. And whole burnt offerings you take no pleasure, but behold, in the scroll of the book it is written of me, I have come to do thy will, O God. Now that's in Hebrews, I think, 6 or 10 or somewhere, but that's a great Christmas verse that most people don't think is a Christmas verse, but it is. It's talking about when he comes into the earth. And there is that little child that who is born to die, and we want to let our girls be reminded of that all the time, and they naturally take to that. So have a lot of those of the creches and the like, the nativity scenes around. We usually have one night we go to a Christmas concert. This is a big part of what we do. It is at John MacArthur's church. If you're in Southern California, you can look up Grace Church's conference, or rather concert schedule. It's always a magnificent enterprise. And at the halftime, John MacArthur gives just the best gospel message you can imagine. It just is always wonderful. He does something different every year, but it's always perfect, with tremendous clarity and skill is communicated, and bookended by this fabulous music with professional performers that are part of his church that give their evening to perform with a full orchestra and all of these different Christmas songs. It's great. So that's we make our little exodus about 45 minutes to an hour away to his church, and we have our evening there, and there's maybe something like that that you can do with your group. Of course, we have Christmas Eve service at our own church, but this is a separate thing that is special for us, and that's that gives more meaning for us. I like to have a date with my girls to buy my wife's Christmas present. And then we go out to dinner. So we have a Christmas date, my girls and I. And if you, if you're a wife and you have boys, you could take the boys out or something, but something special like that, all right? We have already begun watching our Christmas videos. And we've got the standards. It's a Wonderful Life, which I think is just about the best movie ever made, though it turns out it was not much of a hit at the box office when it first came out. But some version of the Christmas Carol, you may not know this, but there were two literary works in the early 19th century that totally transformed what Christmas was to the West, because it had been a time of drunkenness and partying and embarrassment to those who were really Christians, and this is why it was outlawed by Puritans and others, because it was such a wild celebration that it would be better not to celebrate at all than the way they were celebrating. Two things changed that. One of them was a poem called A Visit from St. Nick, which we know as The Night Before Christmas, and the other one was A Christmas Carol by Dickens. And this, there are a number of different variations of this. I like the Alistair Sim version, 1951. I think it's most accurate to the original story, but there are lots of other versions. The story itself is remarkable, and it's worth seeing in a lot of different iterations. We've already watched the Bill Murray version twice. Not exactly classical, but it's still a lot of fun. And that version is called Scrooged. But I recommend some version of the Christmas Carol. We also have a DVD called The Star of Bethlehem. It's a little bit more for the older kids and adults, but it's meant to track, give an explanation of the Star of Bethlehem from a scientific perspective. And it's very, very compelling. It's a DVD that you can watch. Let's see, there's one other that I wanted to mention here. I'm looking on my list. I think there's a DVD, I don't even think it's on this list. I'm trying to think of the name of it. It's relatively new, the last 10 years, and it focuses in on Mary and Joseph and their whole life from the Annunciation all the way to the birth of Jesus and the escape to Egypt. Is it called like the Nativity Story or something like that? We'll figure it out. Amy will have it posted. I love this show. My children love this DVD because it really probes the psychological aspects of Mary and Joseph and what it must have been like for them to have to feel this news and this odd situation where a young woman who is a virgin is with child. The Nativity, okay, it's very well casted, it's very well crafted, it's just a wonderful just insight, I think, and so I highly recommend it. Again, my daughters love that movie. Let's see, what else do I want to suggest to you? Well, we've got a lot of callers on board here, so I need to get back to that, but these are a few things that will help you as a parent to bring Christmas in a very rich sense back to your home. And I think I hope it is a productive enterprise for you. I'm Greg Kokel, and I'll be back with your calls when we return on Stand to Reason.
There's always something new for you on the STR.org homepage, where you'll find sound analysis and careful commentary on the issues challenging Christians today. Along with new articles each month from Greg, Brett, and Alan, you'll also find new blog posts every day, new podcasts and featured articles each week, a new featured resource each month, and updated news about local and online events. So take a few moments to browse the STR.org homepage and see what's new today. And keep coming back to stay informed and encouraged as you grow as a Christian ambassador. Stop by today and every day at STR.org.
Do you want to become a more equipped Christian ambassador? One of the best ways to do so is waiting for you now at str.org, and it's free. Just visit the homepage at str.org and click on Subscriptions at the top. From there, you can choose to receive newsletters, updates, and training resources delivered to your inbox for free. You can choose from Greg's Mentoring Letter, Ambassador Insights, Tactics, Solid Ground, STR e-news from Greg, as well as monthly newsletters from Brett and Alan, and more. They are all loaded with practical, concise, useful tools to help you be a better ambassador for Christ. And they're all free and easy to share with friends. So elevate your expertise as a Christian ambassador right now. Visit str.org, click on Subscriptions, and take advantage of what's waiting for you there.
Back at you here, Stand to Reason. Greg Kokol, got so many people waiting on the line. I'm going to jump right in here and chat with you. This would be Joe, and I don't know where you're from, Joe, but I'm glad to have you on board. Hi.
Yeah, thank you very much, and happy Christmas.
Thank you, and happy Christmas to you.
Yeah, I was calling to see if you could give me a piece of your brain about this topic that I have, but I am a wedding videographer, and... Yeah, it's been going really well, but inevitably we've run into the situation where now we are being contacted by same-sex couples.
Right.
And so just wanted to get your advice on how to tactfully deal with that.
I have thought about this. I can't give you a piece of my brain. That would be painful, but I will give you a piece of my mind on this one. And we have actually gone on record online. I put together some suggestions that I cobbled together from comments I made on a show, and I kind of trimmed it up. But I think the goal that you want to accomplish in this situation is you want to get the prospective client to disqualify you. Now, I'm presuming that you do not want to be a videographer for same-sex unions. Right?
Yeah, that's correct.
And
yeah.
You, and for whatever reasons, comfort or moral qualms, if you simply say no for that reason, you invite a lawsuit. And there are going to be people that will approach you. I hate to say it this way, but I know what happens. That are going to approach you for the reason of getting you to say no because you don't want to do same-sex unions. And then they are going to take you to court. They don't have an interest in having you as a photographer, they have an interest in trapping you into saying that so they could take you to court and hurt you.
Yeah.
Okay. So what I have suggested is the first step is when someone calls, you ask for all the details. And what you say is, I need to check out these details first before I can go any further with you on this issue. What you do is you get the name and the phone numbers of the people in question, you get the date of the event, and you get the location and the person officiating the event. If they cannot give you that information, then you could simply say, well, I can't go any further until I get all that information. But thank you for your call, and then you could hang up.
Mm-hmm.
You're not saying aye or nay. You're just asking for information. Now, once maybe they'll give you the information, then you say, thank you for the information, I'll check this out, and then you say goodbye and hang up. You don't say, I will call again, because that might not be honest.
The way that we're always contacted is through email, through our website, and so we do get a lot of that information. Would you recommend just not responding to... when it's clearly, I know that it's
you have no legal obligation to respond. You could just simply not respond. Yes. Now, what's going to happen if somebody who is interested in your service and is contacting different vendors and one vendor never gets back to them?
Well, just go with a different one.
They're going to go with a different one. I guess they don't want my business. I'm going to deal with somebody. Yes. If it's through emails, all the better. Because you have no moral obligation, no legal obligation to respond to an email. I don't know why you can't just let that die on the vine. I was using as an example a telephone call or maybe a face-to-face where then you gather the information. Now, your next step then is to check out the information independently. if it turns out that you are not able to verify that there are two people of this name who are having a union at this particular church with this or facility with this, then if they do call back, you could say, I checked out your bona fides, they don't check out, and so therefore I am not interested in talking to you any further about this. And then you can cordially say goodbye. And this is meant to weed out people who are just trying to get you to say the wrong thing on the phone and maybe being taped, and then they could have a lawsuit against you. Okay?
Yeah.
It seems to me as long as you don't say no to a same-sex wedding, it's not actionable.
Okay.
So now what
so
if they...
best.
Pardon me?
I'll continue.
What if they keep coming back to you and keep pressing you and it is a legitimate thing? And, well, then it seems to me you can say, tell me what you're looking for in a videographer. Are you looking for somebody who's going to want to capture the excitement and beauty and wonder of the event because they're really in it with you?
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to say yes. And you could say, I'm not your person then because I don't think I can give you what you're looking for. And again, I'm balking a little bit because I'm trying to choose words that cannot be construed as an illegal denial of services. But in fact, if you were getting married, don't you want the photographer to be somebody that can be as excited about the wedding as you are and therefore can bring that excitement to their craft and then provide a wonderful presentation? Wouldn't that be what you wanted?
Yeah.
I think so. And so it might be a good idea for you to actually write out a dialogue that you can use as a cheat sheet when you're explaining this. And you may want to get some legal help with this. And I think an organization like the Alliance for the Defense of Freedom, the ADF, if you go to their website, they may have some stuff already worked out.
Okay.
But I suggest that... I'm chuckling. I suggest that you try to find a way of wording it that will get them to disqualify you rather than have you disqualify them. And the reason I was chuckling a moment ago is somebody did suggest, you say, well, what we do in services like this is our team, just to let you know, prospective client, we always wear T-shirts that says, Exodus 18 or, some kind of religious statement,
Yeah.
And you don't want that to be a, display.
No.
Now, so think of it this way. Try to put yourself in their shoes. They're looking for somebody that will cooperate with them and help them make their event wonderful, memorable. And I think it's entirely fine to say, find somebody like that. I'm not the person that's going to be cheering for you.
Yeah.
Okay?
Now, here's a question. Would this be, in your opinion, if this would be wrong, but to, if they seem like they're persistent, just sort of X that day off of my calendar and then just say, I'm not available and just not take it for anybody then and just make myself unavailable for that day?
Well, I don't think being dishonest is a way of, is the right way of dealing with it. Now, I think you're trying to sidestep the dishonesty by just disqualifying the day, period. And you could say, now that's not a day I'm working.
Yeah.
And if you then followed through with that, and have that a day that you don't work, that wouldn't be dishonest.
Okay.
You could say, well, that day is not available. But just keep in mind, somebody is going to, if they want to press an issue, and then some legal people look at your calendar and see it's empty, then the day is available. Now, for you, if you were going to say, well, it's not available because I decided to take that day off, then then the prosecution is going to say, yeah, you took it off because you didn't want to do this, and that's a violation of civil rights.
Yeah.
So, there's probably a different way you should go about it than that. It's borderline dishonest, and it may not accomplish what you want to accomplish. All right? The thing
all
is,
right,
you don't want to say anything that's going to be dishonest. You also do not want to disqualify them for the reason that it's a same-sex union. That is potentially actionable. But if you can get them to disqualify you one way or another, I don't see that there's any problem with that.
Okay.
And you have no obligation to return their calls or their emails, I think. under the circumstances. Glad to help out. And, Joe, if you figure out a system that really works well, call me and tell me about it, okay?
I will. And here's a Christmas gift for you and the enforcer. Happy Christmas.
Oh, thank you so much. And happy Christmas to you, Joe. All the best, all right?
Right.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye now. Let's go to Timothy in Toronto, and we got a lot of calls from Canada this time around. Tim, how you doing?
Hi, Greg.
Is this my buddy from Toronto with the Z name? No.
Yes, it is.
It is, okay. Good to have you on board, Tim. What's up?
A few months ago, our church made a change in the bylaws into how we characterize members. Like basically, they changed the term membership in our bylaws to ministry partners.
Uh-huh.
And on its face, didn't really concern me that much. But I've been informed by all the wonderful J.P. Moreland material and all the Stand to Reason material, and started really thinking it really depends on what you mean by ministry in that term. And, you know, there was a sermon that, you know, that explained what the motives were. And one of the catchphrases in the sermon was, you know, putting first things first.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started to really get a little uncomfortable with it because they were, you know, the first things first ended up being a lot of the things that Christians are commanded to do. But I have a special view of what the church itself is supposed to be, where it's, you know, if they're ministering to each other, and they're being shepherded, and they're there to grow strong with each other, and that's the first thing. And the second thing would be all the other stuff that we do when we start to, you know, to evangelize and to help the poor and do all the things that we're commanded to do. That's the second thing that comes from within when we're strong and following. And then it's a subtle thing, maybe it's even a semantical thing, but I am a little bit, you know, if we become a group that's focused on just doing all these outward things, then I think something is lost, and the church is not being, you know, we're not, you know, how do you apply church discipline in that matter? You know, you're not a ministry partner anymore because you've done this. You know what I mean? There's something unique about the body of the church.
Yeah.
And I think this kind of lets part of it slip away.
I wonder. I don't know. And it may be just semantics, as you pointed out. When I first saw this question come up, I thought membership, ministry partner. That reminds me of when you drive out of the parking lot and the sign says you are now entering the mission field. Or you'll see a sign that says, and now the service is just beginning, not ending. You know, those kinds of things. Well, I understand what they're saying. And I mean, the mission field, you know, usually that's a phrase that's used to describe foreign places, not your own community. But it's meant to encourage this understanding that we are to be serving as missionaries after a fashion, even in our own community. Or same thing with the service didn't just end, the service is now beginning, because you're going out in your community to serve. I don't find anything troubling about that. If it turns out that ministry partner is a phraseology that is meant in that sense, that it's just reminding us that we're to minister. The phrase itself doesn't distinguish between ministering within the body and ministering through the body to the world. And so it wouldn't foreclose on that first possibility, and that's what it seems like you're kind of assuming. The word ministry is a very broad word. I'm ministering to you right now after a fashion, so we're within the body doing ministry. When we go out and help the Salvation Army or serve food at the soup kitchen, we're ministering to others, different type of ministry. So I think the word ministry is adequate to cover all those options. Unless you think, and even first things first, is not problematic, depending on what they understand the first things to be. Now, if you felt in the church that you were part of that they are excessively devoted to outreach to the exclusion of an appropriate training and building up in ministry within the church, well, then that's a problem for the church. It's not because of the terminology. It's because of their philosophy of ministry. So I think this is what it comes down to, Tim, what they understand this language to really mean. And I suspect it probably is not a big difference from what it used to be. It's just a different way of terming, of stating it to maybe to drive their meaning home a little bit better. You're not passive members. You're active ministers. You know, that's probably what they're getting at.
No, it is true. And then it's also to address the culture, how they're so adverse to anything, being members of anything. Like, membership is an anathema to the modern culture.
Well, I hope that's not the reason. I hope that's not the reason that they're changing the terminology, because, you know, nobody likes to be members. I didn't notice that being anathema to people, but membership, it does denote an identification with a group and an adherence to its principles. But see, this is something that Christians ought to be willing to do. They want to identify with the local church, and there are rules to belong. You can't just do any old thing and call yourself a member of the body of Christ. So if they are trying to get away from this sense of requirements, then that's a problem. But it seems to me that's just the opposite. They're trying to focus more in on individual responsibility.
Well, it is a little bit of that, because it's coming out of a church that's never put a focus on church membership, and such that we're having a church adherence of over 1,000 with a membership of less than 200.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always been problematic in my mind. Mm-hmm. And, I'm not saying we should be banging people on the head, but it should be, if you've been going there for a year or two, you should be somewhat subtly made to feel uncomfortable that you're not a member.
Well, see, but the idea of church membership is a cultural thing, too. I mean, there was no biblical mandate to sign on the dotted line. I don't. This might trouble you, but I've been going to my church for a long time, and I've never officially—actually, I don't know that I've ever officially in any church signed up and said, "Now I'm the member. Here's my name. I'm a part of our community, and I'm a part of our community by commitment and by my presence there and in association with the leadership and all that other stuff." So I'm not going to make a big deal myself about the membership side, the official membership side.
You leave yourself out of the decision-making process with that way, and then again, how does church any kind? You know, it's already not happening in almost churches.
It depends on local church
polity.
There's
no church discipline in that fashion as well.
Well, I don't know that. I don't see there's any limitation for the church disciplining me when I am in a de facto member of the church, regardless of whether my name is on the thing. Paul talked about church discipline, but there were no membership roles in those churches. So I don't see why one precludes the other. And as far as the decision-making process, it depends on the church polity. If it requires that I have my name on this dotted line before I weigh in on any matter, well, then, yeah, that is a liability. But I don't know why you have to have a name on a dotted line to weigh in. That may be a limitation of church polity rather than an abrogation of biblical responsibility.
Okay.
Yeah, so, but those are my thoughts, at least.
Yeah, and it's not a hill to die on, but it's just something that's been just bothering
right,
me.
Tim,
kind of watching how it's...
No alarms go off in my head based on what you've told me, but just keep an eye on it and see what happens. Maybe it will portend something more significant. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah.
All right?
And just a quick update. I called about my colleague who changed genders last time.
Right.
And they've gone for some surgery and have not returned to work. It's been several months. It's gone quite sideways, apparently.
Yeah.
And it's on long-term disability. So,
oh, my goodness. So it was... See, this is another hidden liability of this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sorry to hear that.
Well, we did have... After we spoke, I did manage to have one good conversation with her before she left. So.
Well... You know, maybe you should visit her in the hospital. You know, I don't. Maybe it might be a further opportunity to pursue this. I don't know.
Okay.
All right. Okay. Thanks a lot, Tim.
Bye bye.
Appreciate it. Bye bye. I'm going to skip the. We got so many callers. I'll skip the break, and I'm just going to keep moving here. Let's go to. Hold on. What is that number right there? I can't tell. Oh, that's number one. Let's go to Jesus in Tampa, Florida. Hello, Jesus.
Hey, Greg, how are you?
I presume it's Jesus and not Jesus. How do you pronounce it?
Yeah, I try to go by Jesus because when people say Jesus, there's too much of an opportunity to blaspheme, so I'm pretty sensitive to that.
Okay.
In Spanish countries, it's pretty common.
Yes, it is. It is.
Yeah.
All right, Jesus, what's on your mind today?
Well, there's without going into a long, drawn-out situation here because it's pretty complicated, but my sister-in-law is having an adulterous affair with... with a brother, with my brother-in-law, obviously. At first, when we found out, we were going to try and do the, I guess, the four-step disciplinary approach, mm-hmm. maybe in Matthew, where you approach the person by yourself, and then you approach mm-hmm. with witnesses, and then you have the church,
mm-hmm.
and then you kind of just tell them, hey, you need to be stepped out of the church, mm-hmm. you know. I guess the, what I'm calling a four-step discipline, but or what I consider to be biblical instruction.
Yeah, yeah, I think you're right about that.
So,
by the way, well, these are people, so it's your sister-in-law, your brother's wife, and who is a church member, a church goer, or a Christian of some sort,
yeah.
or at least claims to be, okay?
Well, it's my wife's sister.
It's your wife's sister, okay.
Yeah, my wife's sister, and it's one of those situations where we think she's been saved or rescued, as you said, for
yeah.
a long time, but...
Now this behavior calls you to question it, right?
I'm sorry?
This behavior is calling that into question.
Exactly.
In your own mind, right.
Exactly, and because she's not willing. And there's other issues that are causing
yeah, I'm
this.
Sure.
I mean, there's some serious other issues going on besides that, but... it turns out that she dropped out of going to church, and she's kind of abandoning that, I guess maybe that crowd, if you will, or the body of believers.
Right, right.
So, well, I guess there goes the disciplinary approach.
Yeah, it's going to be hard to discipline somebody who's not available for disciplining, that's right, who's not part of the body.
Exactly.
It doesn't mean that she can't be addressed or talked to by members, Christians, and you can't, you know, kind of go through the process, partly because the goal of those first couple steps is not to get them out of the way so you can disenfranchise that person from the community, the Christian community.
Mm-hmm.
The goal of those first few steps is to win your brother or sister.
That's right.
So there's still a place for those steps. I think, and I was having a conversation with my brother last night about this, and what he said, he's a pastor, and it makes sense that there's a place for that, even if the end game of an unsuccessful encounter isn't excommunication. Let's say there's not egregious sin here, but there's a problem. Well, we do have this thing in place about people coming one by one and as a group and then trying to encourage when there's a significant difficulty. We'll say maybe sin at some level, but not the kind of egregious sin that you are excommunicated for. So the principle still can be played out even if she's not in a church environment. You can still approach that and see how far you can get with it. It might be
that's
that
right.
you win your sister in this case.
Well, we were hoping that was the case. I mean, my wife approached her sister, and it didn't go well. And I believe we had the attitude of restoration. We wanted to restore her to the body. That we mm-hmm. wanted the attitude of being a peacemaker. You know, going
uh-huh.
humble. But it wasn't well received.
Yeah.
And my wife was basically shut out.
Uh huh.
And I'm under the impression that she doesn't want anything to do with us.
Yeah.
I've been friends with my brother-in-law, and I consider him a friend, and my understanding is he was led to Christ by his wife.
Mm-hmm.
But now, he sounds like he's in the dark, and he doesn't know that anything is going on.
Really?
Gosh. And, I guess there's just this issue. I feel like I'm compelled to tell him, partially because I'm convicted as a man. I would want to know right away.
No, of course. I mean, this is a serious assault to her commitment to her husband, to her marriage vows, to other children involved.
Three kids.
Oh, my goodness. Well, look, advice is cheap. And what I mean by that is I can say anything and I don't have to carry it out.
I know, but
it's harder for you. That's kind of what I mean by this.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying. My impulse is to say that the husband should be noted, should be informed, because I don't know what keeping the husband in darkness is going to do. She's living a sinful life, and she's not going to go. It isn't like she had, if she had an occasion of faltering that she was repentant of before you. And wanted to go back into a relationship with her husband and try to keep her marriage intact. To me, that is a very different situation. And then I'd have a different attitude, I think, about about sharing. You know, I don't think you're supposed to share everything to everybody, you know, and tell... I've had people tell me in the past that for years they've held a grudge against me, and they're just confessing it to me and asking for forgiveness. Well, I gave forgiveness, and then I walked away. I was the burdened one. They were unburdened. Now I'm burdened. I said, that son of a gun was thinking this for all that time, and you know, that's what every time I see him, that's what I think about. So it's the words of a whisperer like dainty morsels that go down deep into the heart of a man. Sometimes it's not good for people to know the ugly truth, okay? There's discretion that's involved. In this case, though, it isn't like she made a mistake and she's going to try to repair it, and she's confessed it to significant others, and that has been repaired and repented of, and now she's trying to diminish the amount of damage that her rebellion has caused. No, she wants to continue to live in this with impunity without her husband finding out so she can have both sides, and that to me is a different matter. And if she was, let's just say she was stealing from... Maybe she was stealing from she was embezzling funds from her business. No, but your husband, her boss didn't know, and her husband didn't know, and you think, well, nobody knows, so better I don't tell anybody. No, yeah, I don't think that's be your view. You'd say, I'm going to expose this. This is theft. This is terrible. We've got to resolve this. Well, how is this in a certain sense? How is this different? This is still an egregious sin, and she's stealing from her husband, his trust and all this other stuff. So, again, you should ask some other spiritually mature people, maybe there's something that I'm missing here. But it strikes me, these kind of circumstances need to be resolved. They shouldn't be allowed to go on if we know about them. And this woman is not planning to resolve it at all herself. And her husband is being cheated, literally. And so it just seems to me that you take this out of the darkness into the light. And it's going to be very, very painful. But I don't know how it can be avoided.
Yeah.
Pardon me?
Mm-hmm. I agree with you about being painful. It's painful because I'd like to have the support of my wife's family, you know, and I don't know if I have that, but at some point I have to make a decision.
You're not the one in sin. It's your wife's sister that's in sin, and she's in flagrant sin, and doesn't seem like she's even embarrassed by it from what you've told me. And she has children. So, when this comes out, and these things always do, then what will happen to your relationship with your brother-in-law when he knows that you've known all along and nothing's been done to protect him? So, I mean, I even hate to talk about this stuff. It's painful to talk about it, but it does seem to me that the best thing to do is say, hold the train, stop everything, we're going to, you know, bring light into this. Now, again, please talk to some other people who are spiritually mature, share my ideas and see, am I missing something? But I don't think that I am.
I agree. Just a note of testimony here. I went to a church service on a Saturday night just because I was busy on Sunday. And sure enough, we talked about John chapter 4 and the woman at the well.
Yeah.
It was just closed off so beautifully by the pastor about just approaching each other in grace and not being haughty. Like, hey, this person committed adultery, kick him out, and approaching him as restoration. That's going to be my objective.
But, well, I want to encourage 1 Corinthians chapter 5. Excuse me, I want you to look at, and there is a case where Paul does in abstentia discipline somebody who's in sexual sin. And here's what he says here. He says, it's actually reported there is immorality among you of such a kind that does not exist even among the Gentiles, that someone is having his father's wife. And here's what he says to the Christians in that community. You have become arrogant and have not mourned instead so that the one who had done this deed would be removed from your midst. For I, on my part, though absent in the body, but present in spirit, have already judged him who's committed this. The circumstances are a little different, but I want you to see they're similar in that there is sexual sin. And what Paul is doing is he's flushing this out into the open. He's saying, you know what? You guys aren't dealing with this. I'm going to deal with it. You cannot let this continue to happen. So here you've got a biblical example of this sexual sin, an egregious example of it, Paul dealing with it publicly. And so I think that that is a basis by which we can say, you don't keep letting this woman sin against her husband and her children in this way. You say, you know, put up or shut up. I think it would be fair to meet with her and say, read this passage, if you will, or whatever, but say, look, we are not going to allow you to continue to do this in darkness. We're going to let your husband know what's been going on. This is only right to do. Now, you have a choice what you're going to do about it. But we are bringing this out into light. That would be my counsel, and I hope it's good counsel.
Oh, that's great. That's excellent.
Be sure and run this by somebody else, though. All right? Okay, Jesus.
Thank you so much, Kurt.
Yeah. I'm sorry about your circumstance. All the best to you, all right?
I appreciate it.
All right, yeah. Get back to me if you can in a few weeks or a month or so, and let me know how this turned out. I might learn from it. Okay. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's a hard situation. Oh, my goodness. Well, let's talk about... Writing with Joe. Hello, Joe.
Greg, hi.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Hey, I'll be brief. I don't want to miss an opportunity to thank you and the whole staff for your endurance in equipping Christians on how to think well.
Well,
thank you, Greg, and the whole staff.
I am so glad to hear that and gratefully receive it. So,
I'm excited
welcome.
About a new book that's coming out that you're working on, and it occurred to me to give you a call since you're in the mindset of writing, and you've been doing it for several years. Just anything you might like to share about the process, and do you like using a computer? Do you have any other tools available to you during the process?
Yeah, sure.
Anything you'd like to share on that?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. I'll give you a couple of things that come to mind right off the top of my head, and that is I never start with a blank sheet of paper. And what I mean by that is if I am going to write something, if I'm going to focus on an article or a book, it's because I already have a bunch of stuff for that article or book that I've thought a lot about. So I never, I try never to lose a thought. I discovered something really valuable, and that is that I could use my email device hands-free, talking into the phone, and email myself my own dictation. And I have an iPhone, and it's wonderful for taking dictation because it gets everything almost perfectly right if you speak clearly. It's amazing. So I also have notepads and a pen wherever I go. I have one by my bed. I have one by my reading table. I have one on my desk. Everywhere I go, there is a pen and paper. If I have to jot something down that comes to mind, even when I'm on the air, even when I'm in the middle of public speaking, if something comes to mind, I say it and it works. I say, wait a minute. I never thought of that before. I got to write it down so I don't lose it. You know, I don't want to have to think of that brilliant thing a second time around. It was hard enough the first time. You know, I make a joke or something about it, but I write it down. And so so when I have a collection of things pertaining to a topic I want to write an article about, now I have material I can begin to work with. That's what I mean by I never start with a blank sheet of paper. I don't think, well, we need an article about hell. All right, there goes the paper, and now, what am I going to say? Now, I don't start an article unless I've been thinking about this for a long time, and I've been putting thoughts down on paper, and I've been collecting quotes and odds and ends, so I have something to work with. That's the first thing. The second thing is that writing is work. Somebody said like 5% inspiration, 95% perspiration. Okay?
Oh, yeah.
And that is really true. But in a certain sense, it is all inspiration. So let me clarify that. When I sit down to write and I'm looking at a task and I think, man, this is a, I don't think I can do this. This happens to me a lot. I'm not going to be able to write this article. I can't overcome the obstacles that I'm facing. What I do is I just start manipulating. Oh, I don't know what that is, but somebody just die? Okay, that's gone away. I start manipulating the text. I start moving things around. I don't have to start at the beginning. If you try to think of the first line, and you could get stuck and never get started. Now, that's if you ever saw the movie Throw Mama Off the Train, that was a funny part of that movie. He couldn't get his novel started because he couldn't get the first line. I don't hardly ever start with the first line. I start with what I can start with. If it's in the middle and I've got a paragraph about an idea that I can work it, then I work on that. If all of a sudden I think of something, well, that goes towards the front. Oh, I work on that. if I can, oh, here's a good thing. That's an opener. Good. And I jot it down. But it only comes, the inspiration only comes when I perspire. I have to stay with the job. I have to keep manipulating the text, moving, cutting, pasting, moving things around, in order to get the inspiration flowing, and then something will come to mind. All of a sudden, it'll just appear there, and then I write it down. If I get a clever thing while I'm typing something else, I just type the clever thing. It's a computer. It'll collect it. So it's right in the middle of another sentence. Fine, I don't want to wait for one sentence to end before I write the one I just thought of because I might forget about it. You just type it in. Then when you're all done, then you cut and paste it somewhere else. So I don't want to lose stuff that's really important. And I find that if I stay in the chair and I work at it, it comes. You know, if you build it, they will come. Well, if you sit there and work, it will come. Lately I've been writing on a schedule, like 4 hours a day. I missed a few days lately, but because I have a book deadline coming up, I'm just trying to put in my 4 hours. And I said, what am I going to do for 4 hours? I don't feel creative. Just sit down, go to your chapter that you're working on and work it. Okay. You don't want to, you get stuck on one section. Fine. Move to a different section where you have text that you can work with what you can work on. And little by little, the story or the article forms itself with the effort that I'm putting into it. Sometimes I will stop and I'll sit and I'll read something, like I'll read Mere Christianity, because I like Lewis's voice in that. And as I'm reading,
absolutely.
Yeah, as I'm reading, I'm thinking about, I'm trying to channel Lewis a little bit, you know, and all of a sudden something comes to mind. What I usually do is get out, a notepad and a number 2 Ticonderoga, you know, like the old guys, and sharpen it up, and I start writing. I like writing some of my text longhand because it slows my thinking down and allows me to, if I don't have the stuff, if all of a sudden it comes to mind, I'm going to dictate it. If I got a paragraph or something. But if it's not, I'm just working, I'll just write it out slowly and then get a few pages. Now how do I transfer that to the computer? I dictate it into an email and I send it to myself, cut and paste it. There is something about slowing down and writing longhand that can be helpful at certain stages of writing. William Lane Craig, for a long time, he's not a very good typist apparently, so for a long time he wrote everything out longhand and had somebody else type it. Now he dictates. I just know that because I've talked to him about it. But I find that sitting down and writing longhand is sometimes a way of developing an idea that I don't have fully developed in my own mind. Okay? So those are some ideas. You know, you can call me back. We can talk about it another time. But I've got to go to some other callers and chat with them a little bit. But I hope that helps, Joe. And we'll talk to you another time. I like talking about writing, especially since I am writing. But I do have some other folks like Austin in Sarasota, Florida. Austin, hi.
Hello, Mr. Hochul.
I was just in your fair city 2 weeks ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah, my ailing mother.
Oh, wow.
So nice to talk with you.
Nice to talk with you, too. I listen to you a lot.
Well, good. Thank you.
I've got 40 podcasts to go.
Oh, okay.
I'm a little bit behind, but I just started a few months ago.
Uh-huh.
So. I was just wondering for, like, what are some things to look for in a future spouse, I guess would be the best way to put it.
Okay, so I presume you're single.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I'm 20, so.
Did you know that I didn't get married until I was almost 48 years old? I was 6 days shy of my 48th birthday, which I had on my honeymoon. Did you know that?
I think I have heard you mention it before.
Yeah. Well, which means that I have done a lot of thinking about the question you're asking. Now, that was 17 years ago, but still, I know the process here. So first, I want to just offer you or recommend a book to you, okay, that I found particularly helpful. This book was called How to Find the Love of Your Life. Now, the author of this book is a psychologist from Pasadena who has become quite famous and, I'd have to say, quite wealthy because he is the founder of a dating organization that has been wildly successful called, what is it? Hold on just a minute. That's right. It's called eHarmony.
Oh.
So
wow.
He wrote this book, but it was before eHarmony. In fact, I met with him once for a session to pick his mind a little bit about this issue, and then he developed eHarmony along these principles, and it's been wildly successful, okay? So the ideas in there I found to be really, really, really valuable. So now you have a text you can go to, but let me say a couple of things about the ideas themselves. And I think what you want to find principally is somebody that with whom you are in step with in the most important things in life. That is, the values. If you're a Christian, by the way, this means it goes without saying, is that you to marry a Christian woman. Okay? If not, you're in disobedience. But this also underscores this point that you have to marry somebody if you're going to spend your rest of your life with that person, and that's the kind of commitment you're going to be making. You want to spend your life with a person that is as much like you in the important things as possible. When I say important things, I mean spiritual convictions, and I don't mean just believes in Jesus. I mean, if you're a Calvinist and she's a Pentecostal, this is asking for trouble. In your philosophy of living the Christian life, in the way you make decisions about things before the Lord, in the way you handle money, in the way you understand family and family dynamics, if you believe that the husband is the head of the household and you think that's biblically the right way, and she's an egalitarian who thinks you're both equal and you split the decision-making process somehow, well, that's not a good thing. You want somebody who is going to be as much like you as possible. Okay, I'm really short on time here. Similarly, at a second thing, I think it's really important that you also marry somebody that you are, I'm just going to say, physically comfortable with. And when I say physically comfortable, I mean that you are attracted enough to them physically that you want to be physically near them. You want to hold them. You want to touch them. This bespeaks a kind of a sexual attraction, but it doesn't have to be explosive at that point. And sometimes explosive sexual attraction will cause you to make a wrong decision in other areas. This is why you shouldn't be messing around with sex before you're married, because it distorts the thinking process. Those are two things that are really critical. You'll find a bunch more in the book that I recommended. That's the best I can do, Austin, in Sarasota on short notice here. Thank you so much for your call. And thank you, my friends, for sharing this show with me. I'm Greg Kokel. For Stand to Reason, give them heaven this week. Bye-bye now.
Listening to Stand to Reason. Listen to a new one-hour podcast every Wednesday and Friday. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by giving a gift online at str.org.